welcome to another episode of Disrupting Privilege, Conversations Around Race and Health. I am pleased to introduce my co-host today, Dr. Patricia Robinson. For those of you who have listened to Disrupting Privilege in the past, you may have heard Dr. Robinson in some earlier episodes. Pat is a hematology oncology doctor at Loyola Medical Center in Maywood, and serves on the board of directors for Equal Hope. And I'm excited to say, probably for the first time publicly, that Pat is the president-elect for our board and will be taking over the executive leadership of the board of directors for Equal Hope in May, as our founder, Dr. David Ansel, steps into an official emeritus president role. Pat, welcome to Disrupting Privilege, and share with us a little bit about your history with the board and your passions behind the work that we do.
Well, thanks, John, for inviting me again to be on the podcast. It's always a pleasure to work with you. You know, I'm very excited to serve on the board and happy to transition into the new role as the president of the board of directors. For starters, I will continue to work collaboratively with an amazing group of people. The board is diverse in its makeup. It represents people from different areas of the city, various sectors of the workforce, but with the common goal of addressing healthcare disparities in the Chicagoland area. The organization is innovative, successfully expanding its model in breast healthcare to other women's health issues, including cervical cancer. It pivoted in a time of COVID to address the disparities while documented in underserved populations. It successfully competed for grants at a record level. Serving as the president will be a fabulous opportunity, and I hope to carry on the torch built and nourished by Dr. David Ansel.
Thank you. So well put. It's been such an amazing time, as tragic it has been across our society. We have found ourselves really in the middle of the public discussion on health and health outcomes. And so it's created a unique platform, a unique sort of environment for us to continue our work and to continue to tell our story. I've shared this before on our September board meeting. Dr. Ansel said the world has finally come around to the place that Equal Hope has been saying for a decade, and that is that structural racism is the cause of these disparities, and not genetics and not lifestyle, not every other excuse that we have heard people say, unless and until we address the structural barriers within our healthcare system, we will see disparate outcomes. And so we're grateful to be in the place that we are. I'm also very excited today to introduce our next guest on Disrupting Privilege. We're excited to have Gayla Brockman join us. Gayla is the president and CEO of the Michael Reese Health Trust. And there's Michael Reese Health Trust is such a unique and important component of the Chicago's philanthropic fabric. And there's a unique and interesting story behind it, which I will defer to Gayla to share. But Gayla, welcome to Disrupting Privilege. And if you take a couple of minutes, tell us a little bit about sort of when you came on board and some of the changes you've overseen as you looked at the marketplace and realized there's perhaps a chance to capitalize in a bigger way if you make some changes.
Well, thank you first, both of you, for welcoming me so warmly to this wonderful podcast, John and Pat. It's such a pleasure to get to know you and certainly to have this opportunity to talk about Michael Reese Health Trust, something that not only is my employer, but I'm extremely passionate about the work that we do. For those of your listeners who don't know, Michael Reese Health Trust is the product of the sale of the Michael Reese Health Plan that was inside the Michael Reese Hospital and the hospital itself when it eventually sold. And all of those not-for-profit assets create a public trust. We were started in the early 90s as what we call a private foundation, a conversion foundation. When a not-for-profit is sold, it creates a conversion foundation. It's a public trust. It has a board of directors. It doesn't have an owner. And those assets are governed as closely as possible to the needs of the community, much like what a hospital would have done. We are just a hospital without walls, we like to think of ourselves. So I got to, I had the opportunity to meet the folks for the board at Michael Reese Health Trust almost 7 years ago, actually. I was recruited from Kansas City, where I ran a similar conversion foundation from similar historical background. For those of you who don't know, there are hospitals all over this country that were started by Jewish communities. The communities saw the need for these hospitals because primarily Jewish physicians who are specialists were not welcome. There were quotas on the number of Jewish physicians that got placements at hospitals across the country. And so Jewish communities came together all across the country and built these hospitals that have gone on to be centers of excellence. Boston's Beth Israel is one of those. I ran the foundation at Menorah Hospital in Kansas City. I have worked at Boston Beth Israel, but there are hospitals all over the country that you've probably heard of. And thank goodness they are here because they're still doing excellent work. Michael Reese was also one of those centers of excellence, especially around training. And we can get to that later in the podcast. But it was the proceeds that created the foundation, generally that come from a hospital, also include income from trusts. So grateful patients set up these trusts and they threw off income. And when I took over the foundation, even before I took the job, I told the board there was this opportunity for them to become a public charity, a public foundation. Those words don't actually exist in the IRS vernacular, right, but we use them all the time. We call ourselves a public foundation. And the reason we can become public is because we generate income, public support, naturally through the income from these trusts. And so when we sat down and looked at the math, I showed the board how they could become fully public. Once you become fully public, you can do a lot more. You get a lot more tools in your toolbox. Yeah. But there were systems behind the scene that had to change for us to really support a public charity. And that included fundraising systems, board member systems, financial systems, investment systems. All of that needed to change for us to be prepared and ready to become a public foundation. And once you become public, you can advocate, work with legislators, work with lobbyists. You can do a lot more in that realm. You can raise money, not because you want to grow your assets, but really because you want to grow your impact. Right. And you align your dollars with those in the community that are private and that are public towards a shared goal.
Gayla, did your board and other stakeholders immediately understand why you were pushing for these significant changes in the Michael Reese Health Trust and support it?
No, they did not. I think some of them understood the immediate benefit. One of the immediate benefits you get when you become a public entity is you don't have to pay an excise tax. For us, there were years where that excise tax was hefty. And I don't know about you, but I'd rather give that money to the community than the government and make those investments where I know those dollars are going. And so if you can prove you can be public, you immediately eliminate the excise tax. It's 1 or 2% of your income each year. The second thing is just advancing this idea of lobbying. And what does that mean in legislation? And what does that mean? So while superficially they may have understood, I don't think they understood deeply the way the systems needed to change, the kind of resources that are needed. Just in the last 2 years, our staff has doubled. That's a big pill to swallow for a not-for-profit board that's managed as a fiduciary.
Right.
You know, are we managing these assets? They're meant to be given out to the community. How come our staff has grown so much? But that's the only way to get this work done.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Gayla, we've met once or twice on Zoom and had many wonderful conversations. There's one distinct difference between the two of us. I typically, when I start a new job, never say what we're doing wrong or what we need to do differently. I always say, I want to learn from you. And I've done that every time I've taken on a new role. And then when I get enough comfort and built up a little bit of capital, then I say, all right, we have to do this differently. And so you came in guns blaring saying, we have this opportunity. We're going to shake things up and reorganize the place.
I actually did it during my second interview.
Good for
I said,
you.
If you want to work with me, if you pick me, this is what you're going to get.
That's awesome.
This is where I see your potential. This is where I could see you grow impact. One of my interview questions was, how do you measure impact? I'm like, you got to know who you are.
Yeah.
You got to know what is yours to do, and you've got to listen to your community. And there are things that you need to do as an organization to make that happen.
That's fantastic. Well, it's exciting. And then you had, as you said, you had multiple sort of revenue streams that you had to consolidate into one stream in order to move into this public arena.
So we were made up of multiple trusts and foundations that were all built over many, many years. You know, the hospital was way back to the early turn of the century. So there were multiple funds that were created that eventually created what they called a trust. It was a foundation here, another foundation there, a charitable foundation there. And they were all under like supporting organizations of the hospital charitable mm-hmm. foundation. All of it was consolidated into the Michael Reese Health Trust. Within the confines of the trust, we have multiple funds. Some of them throw off income, I mentioned earlier. Some of them are dedicated to do very specific things, which we honor. And some of them is just general operating support for our grant-making business.
Okay. So when you sort of convince the board that you're going to make, you know, these significant changes to the organization and, you know, you consolidate everything, how did those consolidations and those changes affect your strategic planning or vision for the Michael Reese Health Trust?
Well, let's clarify here. The consolidation of those funds happened a long time ago before okay. GALA. We call that BG.
Okay.
And once I came in and I saw what the assets could be and how you can leverage those dollars as a public trust with your community to align dollars and priorities, you can do a lot more for impact. So one of the things we really needed to do is at the time I came in, look, Michael Reese had been around a long time. They've developed a very strong reputation in a variety of areas, but they were actually funding in 19 areas. And I said to them, wouldn't it be better if you use your expertise, your leadership, your resources to focus in on a smaller group of priority areas and really go deep to know your grantees, understand your community, give your team the ability to listen and engage more with your community. You can't do that in 19 areas, but you probably could do it in a lot less. We got down to 8. That was 4.5 years ago. We're now actually going through strategic planning again, because at that time, I still said 8 was too many. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to bring it down to maybe 4, because we now have added incubation and advocacy to our toolbox. Incubation for us means a new idea, an innovative approach, a promising practice happening in another city, maybe around homelessness. We want to bring here to Chicago, turn it into the Chicago way of doing things, and give it a good, solid opportunity to launch. Michael Reese will even take the risk of hiring the staff, building the infrastructure, raising the money. And then after generally around 3 years, you know whether this opportunity is going to be right. proven. It's a concept we've proven. It was successful. We may have already identified a partner. And if we've identified a partner, we then start going into what we call sustainability. Sustainability can be a policy change. It could be going after federal, state, or city funding, but looking at other options for ways to grow this into a real live, you know, standalone entity or part of a program that's already existing out there. But we're always looking for a partner. We're always starting these things with partners. It might be foundations, it might be city, it might be county, it might be a family member, you know, other family foundations. But areas where we know that we've already developed a reputation, where we've already had a voice, we bring people together. We're really strong in convening. And together, we launch a variety of opportunities. I'm happy to share some of those that came out of COVID, if you'd like.
No, yeah, please, because that's I wanted to get to that. I wanted to get to the partnership, the Chicagoland Vaccine Partnership, but please.
So soon as COVID hit, a bunch of funders across the city with great leadership from Chicago Community Trust and the Joyce Foundation and Polk Foundation came together around what can we do as funders? You know, the state money, the federal money, all that big money had not started coming in. And we saw our community members in trouble, you know, and very targeted trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, your Black and Brown communities are hit at the hardest. Your essential employees are being hit the hardest. And for us, the healthcare workers, how do we protect our healthcare workers? How do we protect those in the safety net communities? We broke off into sectors. Michael Reese and others came together around the healthcare issues of the day. And we were starting to work with our community health centers, who were kind of the low guy on the totem pole for getting PPE and other support. And we said, what do you need to serve your customer? And they came up with some innovative ideas around the delivery of care. And we said, we will give you funding for, so we created a collaborative fund with about 10 funders, came together, created a collaborative fund, parked at Michael Reese, and said to these community health centers that were smack dab in the middle of communities hit hardest by COVID, and said, you tell us what you need and we'll raise the money for you. We'll bring you an evaluator. We got Zoe to come and evaluate. We'll develop community support around what you're doing so that there's a voice informing the work, and we'll support the infrastructure. You know, we're not in that community, but we're good at building infrastructure, we're good at bringing resources. So that's ours to do. And so that's now, we're going soon to go into our third year of supporting these entities. One was at Esperanza, one was at Community Health, and one was at the Southside Christian Community Health Center. And very interesting projects, each unique in their own. And then in August of 2020, we knew a vaccine was close to coming down the pike. And we also knew our communities enough, because we were listening, that there would be hesitation, there would be resistance. And in fact, there's a lot of community members who aren't even thinking about a vaccine. They're thinking about, how do I keep a house in my head? How do I get food? How do I keep my job? How do I take care of my car that's breaking down? They're not thinking about vaccines.
Right.
But we were. And so we started to convene community. It was funders. It was educators. It was healthcare providers. It is city. It is county. It is state, coming together still today, every Tuesday at 12 o'clock. Yeah. We meet as a group to discuss the latest information, the latest data. Where can we target efforts? How do we build communication? What languages do we need to be speaking? What messages are going out that are really effective? And on and on and on, best practice. And it's been this unbelievable community that continues to meet every Tuesday.
So that mechanism is fascinating in a lot of ways. And it's really nice, as you stated, it allows you to stay in alignment with the needs of your community. And I think it allows very organic relationship to develop between those people who are in that space actually doing the work.
Absolutely.
But perhaps just need that next level or extra step in terms of funding, or even the collaborative or networking that comes along with it, in order to make the project sustainable or more impactful than they could have been if just the entity they were operating as. So that being said, that requires a lot of vision on the side of your board, as well as forecasting. So what are the predicted needs in our community? And so one of the things I was really impressed about with your organization is the Chicagoland Healthcare Workforce Collaborative. You know, I work in a space where we recognize that our workforce does not always reflect what our community looks like. And tremendous efforts are being made now almost at every level. But I will tell you, it is a day-to-day challenge. And so can you tell us a little bit about the Chicagoland Healthcare Workforce Collaborative, and what was the motivation to develop the program?
So if you go back, if you're a Chicagoan, which I am not, and I don't think you are as well, John, you are.
No, I'm not.
So you're not. Okay, so none of us here on this call are Chicagoans. But for the Chicagoans who go way, way back, Michael Reese Hospital was known as a training center. In fact, it had one of the early nursing schools. But it was known, and you can still talk to doctors today about the value of their training. I'll be at conferences and people come running up to me and tell me, I trained in Michael Reese. My father trained in Michael Reese. I mean, that word training seems to be prevalent throughout the experience of Michael Reese. Even if you didn't stay, the training was what seems to stand out. And it was a training built on a culture of respect. It didn't matter what discipline you were following, you were respected. You were a nurse, you were respected. You were a surgeon, you were respected.
Michael Reese Hospital was known as this culture of respect for whatever discipline you followed, and a great training facility. And people went off and had amazing careers, you know, wherever. But they kind of looked at Michael Reese as this place that was real life. You got a real life opportunity to learn how to care for the patient and do compassionate care. So Michael Reese one of the things that when I got to do my role is I said to the board, you need to define your values. You need to figure out what is yours to do and where you came from, and take those values and make sure you thread them through everything that you do. And compassion and knowledge and education and risk-taking and strategic and dedicated, those were all the same values that came out of the hospital. And developing workforce is one of those pieces for us that instead of giving fish, you're teaching to fish.
Yeah.
So that people can be self-sufficient, no matter what it is, and education is key to that. So it's been near and dear to the Michael Reese heart since the very beginning. And why wouldn't we support this collaboration of employers coming together with healthcare providers to figure out how we can address stable employment and livable wages for better outcomes, just for our individuals and our families? The collaborative itself, just for history, was born in 2015, a result of a grant from Chase Bank, actually. So very invested, as you probably heard. Chase is a very big partner here in supporting workforce. And we knew that healthcare was a growing industry. We knew it was coming, that it was going to continue to have great, vast opportunity. And we needed to create pathways for our local community to have a place in the healthcare sector. And then, of course, as you know, COVID demonstrated that we have, you know, drastically changed the environment in our healthcare workforce, exploded. So basically what the healthcare workforce does is it unites our employers, our industry partners, and the goal here is to support an inclusive workforce, provide accessibility for unemployed or underemployed populations, and then develop an innovative response to the evolving needs of the healthcare industry, including around hiring practices. So ban the box ideas, how do we discuss it? How do we educate around that? How do we encourage employers to look beyond people's past and give them an opportunity for the future? It follows an industry workforce partnership model. It's proven successful in other sectors where we bring training. We bring training to providers, educators, and employers so that they can meet and discuss issues. It's basically aligning all workforce issues together with resources. Very similar to what we're doing around vaccine outreach and education. Yeah. And any of the other incubation ideas around aligning our resources together with the priorities of the community to make the most impact.
It was a great question, Pat. And it almost seems to me what I've learned over the past year or so, learning more about the Michael Reese Health Trust, it was really part of your DNA, sort of workforce development. You know, Michael Reese Hospital started as a way to create a place for Jewish specialists to use their skill in the marketplace. And so it's a fascinating way to look at the evolution of your DNA as well.
I will say this, it is kind of surprising as we've taken this journey in these workforce issues to see this disconnect between program staff and healthcare teams starting to realize how that they can build their own impact by connecting to volunteers, by connecting to their local pool of talent. You know, there's so much, it's more than 1 + 1 = 2 here. Right, if you nurture your community and you provide these opportunities, the benefits are, we can't even measure. They're so spectacular because you're getting improved patient care. You're going to get patients wanting to come to the hospital, seeing themselves in the providers, and perhaps aspiring to provide care themselves.
Just about everything I've heard you say, Gayla, in sort of the through line of that is listening to your community. So, you know, and that was one of the things that really allowed Equal Health to start off and be effective was for 4 years, we did nothing but study and build relationships and listen. And so when we finally developed protocols and began interventions in the system, it was in alignment with or shoulder to shoulder with the residents of the communities where we had hoped to drive better health outcomes. And so they were part of the solution. And, you know, from some of the early conversations we had, we learned that there's a buzz phrase, and I hope I can get it correctly, but nothing about us without us. And there's something really powerful in that. Like, you know, there's a lot of people come in and you want to do focus groups and you want to tell us how we should live our lives, but we're not included in the solutions. Like, so it's obvious that many of these earlier efforts did not work. And so people said nothing about us without us. Like, if you want to come in, let's do it together, but listen to us. And that was what we did for 4 years, is just listen and study.
And it's why I'm very attracted to Equal Hope mission and the work you do. And we've been a supporter of yours as well. Yeah. Your goals are so in alignment with what we aspire. And, you know, a long time ago, I realized I have these gifts, but not those.
Yeah.
So what do I do with these gifts? And how do I help those that are going to help move the needle come out of, and speak and lift them up and give them the opportunity to make a difference in their world and heal their world. And as a foundation, how privileged are we that we get these resources, that we have these relationships, that we have these voices? Well, they're only so good as the community with the needs. I mean, I'll give you a great example. When we went through a budget impasse for 2 years, work didn't stop, you know, regardless of them not having money. Money's not key here. It helps, but we're not the essential players, okay? The essential players are the people on the ground doing the work to change the world. And my role, I have recognized, is to ensure that we make it as easy as possible for them to do that. That's why incubation is such an attractive piece for our board, because we understand if we really believe in something, it's our job to raise the resources and help build the infrastructure, and their job to do what they do best.
That's really interesting and so important. And incubation really is an important component, because there's so many good ideas that, you know, would have an impact if you could just get off the ground, if you just had somebody believe in you. You know, I wasn't with the organization when it started, so I can only tell this anecdotally from what I've heard. But, you know, we got $1 million from, I think, Susan G. Komen, and $1 million from the American Cancer Society. And we sort of put together this plan and began doing research and trying to understand and build relationships. And quite frankly, for the first 10 years, it was a struggle to keep this organization funded. And Anne-Marie did a great job of keeping us relevant and part of the marketplace and keep us moving forward. And now we're in a very different place. And, you know, for our listeners, we are one of the probably 80 different Chicago-based, community-based organizations that are part of the Chicagoland Vaccine Partnership and actively participate every Tuesday from 12 to 1, both I do and Paris, my colleague, as well as Anne-Marie when she can. It's really a powerful group. And some of the things that have been put in place to address these sort of like the messaging, like what messages are working and what aren't, and just understanding the nuances of language and how, you know, one person speaking one way means something different for someone else saying it. And so how do you find the right message to get through and to overcome the barriers that prevented people from, you know, getting the appropriate kind of care?
I mean, think of the public health workforce we organically created through this method. Every Tuesday, this group comes together to work together towards a shared vision of eliminating COVID, eliminating death, eliminating a disease, and moving us in a direction that we share this vision together. So while COVID eventually, please God, becomes a everyday thing and not a crisis managed effort, I don't want to lose this. I don't want to lose this problem solving. I don't want to lose these variety of folks coming together to address something and the shared energy and shared vision. And our hope is that Chicago Vaccine Partnership lives on through a public health workforce that is being created through training, through engagement, through community meetings and events, not only is it the Tuesday meeting, but we provide these mini grants to community-based organizations that may not have an audit, they may not have financials, they may not even have much of a staff, but they have the ear of their community. Right. And they're able to get out there and convey an appropriate message in the way they need to about moving the needle.
So powerful.
Yeah. So it's, to some level, the Michael Reese Health Trust is establishing a brain trust. And that is by bringing people together to problem solve, you intentionally or unintentionally are developing methodology that hopefully can translate to the next problem. And that problem will be there, right? So it's not as if it's wasted effort.
We've had plenty. Yeah. In the last 6 years that I've been here, we've had plenty that we could have brought this group together to help solve. Yeah. And exactly. Oh, how powerful would that have been?
Right.
Exactly. So figuring out processes, methodologies is really, I think, an unintentional consequence of when you bring people together like this.
Yeah.
And it's such a diverse group. You have community-based organizations speaking. You have people representing communities. They might not even have an organization. They're there to talk on behalf of Southeast Asians. Mm-hmm. They're there to talk about Chicago survivors of long COVID. Yeah. You know, the very specific communities they're coming to talk on behalf of and give a voice to and help create solutions and strategies and communication around.
So can I give an example of that? And it always amazes me because it's such common language now, but I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe it wasn't. So you had people at the table who recognizes that in underserved communities, there was a higher incidence of, let's say, three basic diseases, diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. Okay. And, you know, somebody at the table might say, well, you know what? If patients saw their doctor or took their medications, they wouldn't have this problem. Somebody else was saying, well, if they exercised and ate well, they wouldn't have this problem. Somebody else at the table then says, well, you know, they don't have any grocery stores in that neighborhood. So then the concept of food desert came around. And then somebody else said, well, you know, there's no active pharmacies in that community.
Right.
So it's interesting how you could have people at the table with different skill sets looking at the same problem, but because their vision was tunneled or that wasn't their bandwidth, they didn't recognize how they all were right and how they all fed into the same problem and therefore lent itself to problem resolution.
Just the viewpoint that you had, just that example, you have all those different people at the table sharing their different perspectives. Just that alone,
right,
of enlightening each other to the different perspectives will result in something positive.
Absolutely.
And we have a tendency in our culture to want to blame the victim or blame whoever it is, it's their fault. And then therefore I can say, well, then it's not, I have no issue. I have not my issue. I mean, I have this conversation with extended members of my family all the time. And, you know, their assumptions as to what we're doing is, well, it's genetic. Well, no, it's not. Well, it's behavioral. You know, if they ate better, well, okay. I mean, if I ate better, you know, like let's rather than finding blame, let's figure out where the problem is and how to prevent the problem or overcome it. It's so true.
Look, as we all know, and we heard in the papers, vaccine hesitancy, there was a lot of blaming around, why aren't you taking a vaccine? You know, yeah, what's wrong with you? Well, let's dig deeper and find out. It's right. Not that there's something wrong. There's multiple reasons why someone would not run to take a vaccine or get right. Their child vaccinated.
Right.
It was our job to discover and address them.
In our last episode, I shared with you, Ed Stellan said something fantastic. And he said, let's give people what they want until they want what they need.
I thought that was so spot on perfect,
you know, yeah. Rather than handing people what we think they need, let's give them what they want until they want what they need. That was really well said.
Brilliant, man.
You know what? I have a feeling we could probably go on for another hour, but I do want to respect both of your professional times as well as our listeners. And so, Gayla, we're going to have you back for another one sometime real soon. But thank you so much for making time for this. It's fascinating to hear a little bit more about the Michael Reese Health Trust story and your leadership, some of the changes you've overseen and the impact that you're measuring right now. And we do look forward to deepening our relationship, both professionally as Equal Hope and the Trust, as well as personally as we move forward.
And thank you so much for your time. This has been a delight chatting with you. This is something I don't get to do very often, so yeah. I'm very honored and just really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's truly a pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm going to end with a little commercial. So if you have listened to this whole episode and you appreciate the content of what we're trying to create here at Disrupting Privilege, conversations around race and health, I'm going to ask you to do two favors. One is to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And also, if you would rate this episode, it does help us to move up the leaderboard, so to speak, as people are looking for content on the marketplace. So if you would like us or rather follow this podcast and then rate us, it would be grateful. We'd be grateful. With that said, we thank you so much. We look forward to interacting again very soon. And with that, we will say adieu.